do. That, of course, is a very tricky issue. But ages ago, I did some work on black hole evaporation, and not directly, but certainly relating to what is usually called the information paradox. Recently, I have become interested in this problem again, but from a slightly different point of view than the previous work. So it doesn't involve Euclidean gravity or anything like that. So I thought it would be a good idea to explain what the black hole information problem was and why it is so difficult. And this I will do in a very non-technical way, for the very simple reason that if it were technical, it would take several weeks to explain precisely all the details of everything. So this is a sort of non-technical version of the black hole information problem. So I guess the first place to start is with what a black hole is. Now, of course, presumably Rob Myers spent a very long time describing what this was, but I don't know what he did. So he presumably described the Schwarzschild metric. Did he describe anything else? Different coordinate systems. Did he describe Penrose diagrams? Nema sort of did. Okay. Can I use Penrose diagrams? Yeah, Lenny certainly did. Okay. Well, in that case, I think the place to start was with the invention of black holes, and I bet you Rob did not tell you about this. The black holes were in fact discovered in 1784. No? Yes? By a clergyman living in Yorkshire called John Michell. And he did the it's about the only diagram I can draw properly, is a circle with someone standing on top of it. What he did was to say, suppose you had some object sitting here and you wished it to escape, then you would throw it up with some velocity v. And he calculated the escape velocity of that object. And he then said, now, suppose, for example, that escape velocity is greater than the speed of light. He knew the speed of light was finite because you could measure the speed of light, roughly speaking, from watching the eclipses of the moons of Jupiter. And so he discovered that if 2gm over c squared r was greater than 1, and r was the radius of the object in question, and g was Newton's constant, m the mass, to see the speed of light, then light could not escape from this object. That, of course, is in Newtonian theory. What is remarkable is that in general relativity, the formula is exactly the same, even up to factors of 2. So this man really was the first person to discover these objects. They were put on a firm mathematical footing by, I guess, by Karl Schwarzschild in 1916, who constructed the first metric which described black holes. You might be a bit suspicious about this date, actually, because this predates the publication of general relativity by 2 years. But it appears to be true. I don't quite understand that, but nevertheless a fact. Yes, he did. That's because the work that he did to discover the Schwarzschild metric was done after he was fatally wounded in World War I. It took some time.
What was the method of discovery in 1784 black holes?
Theoretical discovery. He just calculated the escape velocity and then said if that's bigger than the speed of light.
So he used the crepuscular theory of light?
No, he just says, no, he just calculated the velocity. Didn't use any theory of light, he just knew it had got a speed. That doesn't require, that's the whole point, it doesn't require a theory of it. For a long time, people had the idea that the kinds of things that happened in the event horizon were sort of fictional because the equations broke down there. We now know that to be untrue. And a second round of skepticism occurred in the 1960s because people used to complain that the density was absurd. But, so it's a good idea to keep some numbers in mind, and I'm going to keep some numbers in mind here. So let's look at the mass of a black hole, its size, its density. So a one solar mass black hole has a size of roughly 1 kilometer and a density of 10 to the 15 grams per cc, which if you think about it is identical to that of nuclear matter within a number of less than 10. So you could argue that this was extreme. But the kind of black holes that you find in the centers of galaxies, which have masses of up to presumably 10 to the 11 solar masses, have a density of that of water and a size of roughly one light month. And there is nothing extreme about that, apart from the fact that they are very large, but this is, roughly speaking, the mass of a galaxy anyway. So this is not extreme. Water, no one is going to tell you that water is extremely dense. Of course, density scales like 1 over m squared, because the size, remember, scales like m. So if you have things of less than one solar mass, so for example, the kind of things contemplated by string theorists, where these things would have a mass of around 10 to the 19 GeV, their size would be 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, and the density is 10 to the 94 grams per cc, which is extreme. At least, of course, that's classically.
I'm sorry, I missed the first line. The galaxy is a size of only 1 million.
A black hole would be that. Black hole containing 10 to the 11 solar masses would be, roughly speaking, one light month across. And if you want to understand what the geometry of these things is, so you say NEMA did Penrose diagrams, well, let's draw a not Penrose diagram to start with. So one way in which you can describe a black hole is to draw a picture that looks something like this. Where here is some kind of collapsing matter which forms the black hole. This represents the event horizon. And this little wiggly thing here is what you think of as being the singularity. And you can recognize what's going on by thinking about what light cones do. If you are a very long way away from the black hole, then a light cone is uninfluenced by the black hole. And so it looks something like this. I should say that time is going this way and space is going that way. But if you're close to any gravitating body, what tends to happen is that the light cones tip over, indicating the attractive force of gravitation, to look something like that. And the event horizon is characterized by a surface where they have tipped over so much that they cannot escape from this surface. So if the light cones are tipped over by that much and you're sitting here, you move outwards at the speed of light, then all that will happen is you just sit along this surface. The singularity, as drawn here, looks like, we'd probably just simply say that the curvature in some fashion becomes infinite. And then we'd probably say, well, I don't really know what that means. And you would hope that the quantum effects would somehow make sense of what this is about. So the Penrose diagram is really the same diagram as this, but twisted round. So in a Penrose diagram, what you do is you arrange for all the light cones to always go straight up and straight down, like that. So wherever you are in the diagram, they always look like this. I guess he must have said all this, but it does no harm to repeat it. And then a picture of what this diagram looks like is something like this. So this is the singularity. This is the collapsing body. This is the event horizon. And astronomers tend to sit out at infinity at very large distances from the object in question and peer with a telescope at it. So they live here. And what they look at is their past light cone. So their past light cone looks something like this. So they see this body, like this. What they see is it at later and later times, but they never see beyond this surface, which is the horizon itself. If you sat on this surface, here, here, and here, as you got closer and closer to the event horizon, you would be more and more redshifted as seen by an observer at infinity. So you get more and more redshift as you get closer to the horizon. That's better. Who turned it on? The air conditioner, that is. You better keep it on because it was rather hot without it. Yes.
What is the line that the astronomer is sitting on?
This is usually called Scry Plus, or future null infinity. Let's see. Rob Myers must have talked about the Eddington Finkelstein coordinates. Okay. So, if the metric were exactly Schwarzschild, then U equals T minus R minus 2m times logarithm of the modulus of R minus 2m. And that's a sort of retarded time coordinate. And if you go up in this direction, that corresponds to increasing U and R going to infinity. So R is enormous, and U is increasing as you go in this direction. So that's sort of naturally what astronomers do.
Next question, is that saying that the astronomer falls into the singularity?
No, this point here, although it's usually drawn like that, I think we should leave a little bit blank that looks like that. So you can go up to here, you never actually end up at this point, and it's not the same as the end of the singularity. So if you were inside the main region of the space-time, outside the horizon, and you were moving along a time-like line, most time-like lines end at R finite, T goes to infinity. And they correspond to lines which look something like this. They all look here, but this point has been sort of crushed down. So if T goes to infinity and R is finite, you end up here. This is what happens if you go out to infinity in a light-like direction. So that's what astronomers will see. This makes it absolutely clear that if any unfortunate observer falls behind the horizon, so has got to this point, They can't move faster than light. The light cones on this surface look something like this. So they are constrained to always move towards the singularity and eventually reach it. So everything which has got inside the horizon will reach the singularity, like it or not. There is no escape. Within the context of classical relativity, which is the only theory that we half understand, the singularity is best thought of as a boundary of space-time. So, if you think about that, it looks like this observer here has fallen off the edge of space-time, which is at least philosophically rather alarming. Whether it's really like that, or whether it's really like, I mean, sailors used to worry about falling off the edge of the Earth. So do we know that it's like that, or is it like the surface of the Earth and you don't have to worry? Nobody knows. It's true that the curvature here is going to infinity in some vague sense, which I could make precise. You see, if you ask what actually happens, I could tell you what the Riemann tensor was, but you could quite convincingly argue that you do not care what the value of the Riemann tensor is, because by making a coordinate transformation, the numerical value of the components could be absolutely anything you like. Because after all, the components of a vector are anything you like, depending on what basis you pick it. But you can get around that by calculating something which is scalar, and does not depend on the coordinate system you chose. And if you did that, you would end up with 48m squared over r to the sixth. And in that sense, you could say that as r goes to zero, the curvature goes to infinity. The next thing that you really have to sort of get to grips with is that if you stay outside the black hole in this region, equivalently this region in this picture, then you cannot measure what happens inside the black hole. The best you can do is to make observations up to the event horizon here, but not beyond. So what goes on in here, unless you decide to fall into the black hole, is completely and utterly secret from the outside observers. The only thing that you ever need to suppose to find yourself in this position is some notion of causality, and a universally attractive theory like gravitation. It doesn't really even depend on the details of the theory or extreme physical circumstances, as we have seen over there. That's it. Fiddling with the local, with the laws of gravity to give it something repulsive will not fix the problem of having black holes that are huge. There's nothing exotic about any of the physics involved here, other than the fact that you form an event horizon. Space-time is not hugely curved at the event horizon. In general, from this formula, you can see that at the horizon, r equals 2m, the curvature is of the order of 1 over m to the fourth. And so the bigger the black hole is, the less the curvature is. Yes?
A picture of how something could escape from a black hole if gravity were not universally attractive.
How you could escape?
Or rather, how you could measure anything about.
You cannot measure anything inside.
Okay.
No, he said if.
If it were not attractive.
Right. Why is there an intuitive counterexample when you don't have attractive gravity?
For theories which at long range are general relativity, then it's provided you have Lorentz effects, and that is after all what I mean by causality. So at each point in space-time, you construct a local light cone which looks like the ones here, then the answer is no.
Okay. So you don't have like a seriously screwed up theory that's not GR at long ranges?
Not GR at long distances.
Okay.
The examples of such theories are that are commonly fashionable are the Harada-Lipschitz theory, but I don't think they're going to last very long. So that, roughly speaking, is what a black hole is. It's a region of space-time which you cannot escape from. Yes?
Why do you care about what's inside because you've never seen anything go into it?
Because you can go into it. There's nothing stopping me moving along a line that looks like this. There are lots of people I would wish would go into black holes. You aren't one of them. The fact that you can is enough to cause a problem. The question that you might want to know about black holes now is, what are the most general black holes that you can imagine? What properties can black holes have?
L, M, Q.
L? All right. I usually call it M, J, and Q, you say.
Oh, we're calling it J.
I always call it J. It's just me. Angular momentum. Electric charge. If I put the word stationary in front of this, which if you like you can think of as being a sort of generic equilibrium state, what is remarkable is that these are the only things which distinguish different black holes. So if I tell you the mass, the angular momentum, and the charge, then that's everything there is, apart from the history of their formation.
Could you expound on what you mean by stationary in a black hole?
Technically speaking, there exists a vector k, killing vector. Did he tell you what killing vectors were?
Yes.
Okay. There's a killing vector such that ka d by dxa equals phi translations at least. No, phi translations. And I think I want to add an extra caveat in here, asymptotically flat. The good thing represents an isolated system. That's it. Yes.
So one of our homework problems was to prove that the Schwarzschild solution was the only solution even when you didn't demand time translation invariance for
Really?
Spherically symmetric. Yeah.
Well, with what?
Maybe I misread the question.
Not rotating.
Oh, okay.
And
asymptotically flat.
Asymptotically flat. And vacuum.
Yeah. Well, he didn't demand vacuum, but he implicitly assumed.
You have to demand vacuum, otherwise it isn't true.
He did demand vacuum.
You see, if you were allowed to have a Maxwell field, then you could have the Weiss and Nordstrom solution, which is static and spherically symmetric. But not a solution to the vacuum equation.
Use the equations G mu, like capital G mu is equal to zero.
Equal to zero.
He only said that one component was zero.
But that's the solution
that
you use. Use like GTT and GRT and so on equal to zero. Yeah. That means you're in a vacuum.
The point is, he only demanded that one component of the.
Let me tell you what you do to find it. You solve the Einstein-Maxwell equation. where this is the energy momentum tensor of the electromagnetic field. And A, if you put this equal to Q over R, naught, 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 in the obvious Schwarzschild type coordinates, you will end up with the Riesner-Nordstrom metric. I was going to show you what the metric corresponding to mass, angular momentum, and charge actually was, just to show you that these metrics are known and tractable. So the metric corresponding to this is, I must say, I always have to look this up because it's impossible to remember, minus into 1 minus 2mr minus q squared over a sigma dt squared minus 2a sine squared theta into 2m minus q squared over sigma d phi dt. It's probably the fact that you've got these cross terms here which give you lack of uniqueness, plus chi sine squared theta d phi squared over sigma plus sigma into dr squared over delta plus d theta squared, where sigma is equal to r squared plus a squared cos squared theta. Delta is r squared minus 2mr plus a squared plus q squared. And a chi is r squared plus a squared all squared minus delta a squared sine squared theta. So that's the most general metric. There are no others. You can invent any kind of field you like to couple to the right-hand side of the Einstein equations, and you will not find any more stationary, asymptotically flat black holes. That's it. If you think about this, this is rather bizarre, because that means that you know nothing about the history of a black hole if I just present it to you. You cannot tell whether it was made out of scrap iron, stars, you, me. To use Stephen Hawking's example, leather-bound volumes of Proust. Quite why that's important, I don't know. So given a black hole, you can tell nothing about its history. It's simply a black box with specified by those three numbers, Tibra. Yes, it looks like a point charge. So electrical point charge. It has a mass, which you could measure gravitationally. It has an angular momentum, which you could measure by probably by frame dragging. You could, if you feel slightly more sophisticated about it, observe that all of these things are conserved quantum numbers which are associated with long-range part of some kind of gauge field. So this is the L equals zero part of the electromagnetic field, and these are the L equals one parts of the gravitational field. That's not a coincidence. So that's a sort of fundamental property of the whole thing. So whatever you get is independent of its history. To see how extreme this is, you could imagine that I take in one hand, well, you better not imagine this too carefully, a lump of matter, and in this hand a lump of antimatter. We all know what happens if I bring the two together. There will be some incredible explosion. But suppose you had two black holes, one formed of matter and one formed of antimatter. and you brought those together, they would be indistinguishable, and you could put them on top of each other, and nothing would happen. You just get one big black hole.
Why would they be indistinguishable if they would have opposite charges? So they wouldn't be indistinguishable.
Well, make it out of, well, it means Q be the opposite for these two things? Make them both neutral. Hydrogen, anti-hydrogen, iron and anti-iron, whatever. Yeah.
So if it only has Q, then if you're going slow enough, then you can't see any magnetic field.
Right.
All you see is the electric field.
These specify the entirety of the properties. Now, you ask about the magnetic field.
Yeah.
If you have something with charge Q, and you made it spin, and give it angular momentum, then of course it will look like a magnetic dipole. But that magnetic dipole, its dipole moment is determined entirely by J and Q. It's not determined by anything else. So that would be a derived quantity rather than an intrinsic quantity. Because it's still the case that if I knew Q and J, I could figure out what the magnetic fields were. A solenoid. Well, let me do something which you might imagine doing. You might say, well, what, can I throw a bar magnet in? Well, you can do that. That will only change the mass and the angular momentum. It will change the angular momentum because it has all the iron atoms spinning the same way. It changes the mass because it weighs something. It won't change the electric charge. So J will go to the new J, and Q will go to the new Q, and M will go to the new M, but it won't change anything else. So all the other things which you could derive from it will still be the same.
So if you did the iron and
bolt
experiment,
then
we put it
inside
a black hole.
You'd never notice. And what would you do with the end of the solenoid?
Well, you put the battery also inside the black hole.
All end up inside.
Suppose we had a Van de Graaff generator and we put the positively charged bit of it into a black hole. Then we have net charge in the outside universe.
So you want me to drop some kind of wire in here and charge it up?
No, we just have a charged ball from the top of a Van de Graaff generator, so there's a lot of positive charge.
Yeah.
And we drop it in. So
okay,
you have net negative charge outside.
That's fine. What's wrong with that?
You shouldn't have net negative.
You've given the black hole positive charge. That's fine.
So you can measure the electric field from the positive charge inside a black hole.
That's the whole point. You can measure the charge, but not anything else. So for example, you can't measure the baryon number. That's because the baryon number is not associated with a long-range gauge field. Whereas electric charge is associated with a long-range gauge field. At this point, you might be
Is that also why you don't have, let's say, color being a part of that? I mean,
I wish you'd never asked that.
I can, like, pretend I
can. You can, but I can't. So I actually once wrote a paper entitled Black Holes and Colored for precisely that reason. The answer is you can't have color. But color, of course, is confined, so we don't have to worry too much about it.
Okay.
Unless, of course, you do what we're about to do next, which we don't have to worry about.
Does that mean the fact that everything also depends on the fact that it's the interaction of our long range? Does that mean that if I'm close enough to the black hole, I will be able to measure volume number and color?
No, it doesn't help. You can tell that, of course, you can have arbitrary large. given that you've got some macroscopic properties of black holes, like M and J and Q, you might start to worry about whether or not there were some other macroscopic quantities that you could associate with the black hole. So two things that you could have are an angular velocity, which basically tells you how fast the event horizon is rotating. And you will discover that this, in terms of the objects M, J, and Q, is equal to, and again, it's one of these horrible things I can never remember. It's J over M divided by M plus the square root of M squared minus J squared over M squared minus Q squared, all squared plus J squared over M squared. It's just easiest to think of the angular velocity as depending basically on J and some other stuff. What it means is that here you have this black hole.
I mean, if I wanted to, you know, measure it and test that formula, like.
I'll tell you how to do it.
I mean, what is rotating?
What is rotating is that if you were dropping something into the black hole, you would discover it would be being dragged around, and at the moment that it went in, you would discover its angular velocity was equal to that if it started off at rest at infinity. But that's not how you measure it in practice. I will show you a different way of measuring it. There's also an electrostatic potential. Which is proportional to Q, hardly surprising. And then there's an additional factor of M plus square root of M squared minus J squared over M squared minus Q squared, divided by the same thing on the bottom that you find there. I'm not going to write it out again. In common with many other objects that are large, you could try asking what its temperature is.
How can there be a Q in angular velocity? I mean, that seems highly counterintuitive.
Okay, so the expression that you're used to seeing is J equals moment of inertia times angular velocity.
Yeah.
So what that tells you is that this expression here is equal to 1 over the moment of inertia. So that tells you the moment of inertia, which governs the shape of the body, is a complicated function. So this object is 1 over the moment of inertia. And similarly, if I tell you that I relate an electrostatic potential to a charge, you can regard this thing here as being 1 over the capacitance.
Does that mean then that the Schwarzschild radius actually depends on Q as well as M?
Yes. And J.
Oh.
In the case of these charged rotating black holes, the analog of the horizon is at, I didn't want to say that, but I will. Get that formula. The formulae aren't worth remembering. The important thing to remember is that there is a charge and there is an electrostatic potential and hence some capacity. And the capacity is given by this sort of geometrical looking construction. Similarly for the moment of inertia. If someone asks you to calculate the temperature, well, if someone asks you to measure the temperature, you'd probably say it was zero. That's because one way to measure a temperature of something is to stare at the object that you have got using a bolometer, which measures the black body radiation from it. Nothing can escape from the surface of a black hole, so you will get zero. The other thing that you will be inclined to measure is the entropy. That is the logarithm of the number of ways that you could have built the black hole, according to the Boltzmann definition. intuitively, we have just learned that the way that the black hole does not depend on how you built it. Any number of different ways of forming a black hole all seem to be equally good. It's described by a small number of things. So you would say, well, the number of different ways I could have made a black hole of given mass, angular momentum, and charge is infinite. So the entropy is infinite. And that's fine. Doesn't contradict anything. The next thing that you would be inclined to do is to say, well, if I have an equilibrium black hole, the simplest thing that I can do to it is drop things in and ask what happens. You start off with a black hole here of M, J, and Q. You drop something in, and it will settle down to a new black hole of mass M plus delta M, angular momentum J plus delta J. I'll take this to be parallel to that, otherwise life becomes difficult. Charge Q plus delta Q. So you might expect to find that you end up with a nice formula for the change in energy of this system, delta M. And you do. You discover that there are two terms. There's a phi delta Q. You can regard this as electrical work done by adding a small charge delta Q. And you discover something which corresponds to the rotational work, which you get by speeding up the rotation of the black hole. If you add an amount of angular momentum delta J, you multiply by omega to get the change in energy. And then you discover a purely geometrical term, kappa dA over 8 pi, where A is the area of the event horizon, which is equal to 4 pi times this distance squared. I'm going to change that to an R plus so that we don't become confused. And kappa is a geometrical quantity which is usually called the surface gravity of the black hole, and is equal to square root of m squared minus j squared over m squared minus q squared divided by 2 to m plus square root of m squared minus j squared over m squared minus q squared all squared. Another one of these complicated things. And there you'd be fine. You might say, well, this is energy and this is energy. What's this got to do with energy? And at best, you would say, well, it looks something like surface tension times change in area. So it looks like some kind of soap bubble type thing. You then start to worry whether or not this is really the right formula, because this looks awfully like the first law of thermodynamics, in which case, this thing had probably better be TDS. And you might be a bit worried about that, but if you think that the temperature is zero and the entropy is infinity, you sort of fudge this away and stop worrying too much. Until you study this problem harder and you make a second discovery about these variations, that is, as long as what you chuck in has got positive energy, you discover that delta A is positive, or possibly zero, which looks awfully like the second law of thermodynamics if you thought the area was the entropy, which seems to go along with this. Now, everything I've said so far is classical. And there is nothing wrong with the consistency of this classically, although you would regard this as deeply suspicious, especially in light of that. So let's go back to our original picture, of black holes forming as a result of gravitational collapse. You could imagine that instead of doing a classical treatment, you ask yourself, how do quantum fields behave on this background? What you'll discover is that if you start off with a vacuum in the remote past, apart from this matter here, that vacuum is unstable to pair production. So what happens is that you pair produce particles in this region, just as you do in Minkowski space. And most of the time, nothing happens. Except that occasionally, this happens close to the horizon, and one particle gets there. It's gone in. Having gone in, it's got to keep going in. So if one's going in, the other's coming out, and will escape to infinity. The details of that calculation, hopefully, will be done by someone later in the year. But what you see is a flux of particles at infinity. That is precisely black body at a temperature T equals kappa over 2 pi and a factor of h bar on top, from which you would conclude that the black hole itself has temperature, because if you're looking at the black hole with your hypothetical bolometer, what you'll see is black body radiation. So you will infer black hole has a temperature T equals h bar kappa over 2 pi. This is usually called the Hawking temperature, since he was the first person to discover this fact. You will notice that if you take the classical limit h bar goes to zero, the temperature goes to zero, as you would expect from everything that we have learned classically. You can now identify this term, TdS, with kappa dA over 8 pi, and you will conclude that the entropy is equal to A over 4 h bar. That is not a huge problem, but you will see that something interesting happens as h bar goes to 0. This goes to infinity, which corresponds precisely to our classical picture. So we infer that this is not anything other than what you'd expect to complete the first law of thermodynamics, namely TdS. So that's the situation that you find yourself in at the end of the sort of semi-classical process, where you discover that black holes are perfectly reasonable, well-behaved thermodynamic entities. It is the next stage that is going to lead to trouble. Now there's a question, which obviously now is the right time to ask, whatever it is.
Assuming this is like the first law of thermodynamics and figuring out what you can put in there, like to cancel out the T, or do you somehow calculate entropy?
Yes.
Like, and if you calculate, what states are you counting?
I have absolutely not the faintest idea of what states you're counting. There are various claims as to what you count. Claims, counterclaims, discussions which have been ongoing ever since this was discovered. I don't think there is a convincing answer to that. There are two half-convincing answers, and they are different, probably incompatible. Can we discuss that later?
I don't know if this is a big name, but if those are massive particles, which we are...
Massive particles. The answer is that you can include the mass of particles, and of course, even massive particles have black body radiation. It's just that their distribution is a bit different.
Yes.
So you can involve all this stuff in your Bessel function. You get all that.
But we've now created mass in the universe. The mass of the black hole has increased. The mass of the rest of the universe has increased.
That comes next.
Okay. Sorry.
You would have made an interesting discovery.
So your approach doesn't require them postulating the generalized second law of thermodynamics?
No. No. It requires this to be the second law of thermodynamics. That's it. Nothing else. The generalized second law, I take it that you mean that the entropy of the universe is the thermodynamic entropy for this black hole area.
Okay.
No, I would claim that this is the best thing that you can do if you wanted to believe that that was true. You can sort of derive it by looking at the
entropy of the universe. Yeah, that's what I was wondering was, because it just seemed odd to me that you never had to postulate it, yet some people seem to...
Yeah, but you remember that you might have been reading something written before that this was discovered.
It was written in 2007.
By who?
Well,
he should know better. He should know better. Once you've seen this, you really shouldn't doubt it. The generalized second law is...
Small fairness, it might have just been a bit of... Survey and
it was. I think that the paper was entitled "The Holographic Principle" and was a review of the holographic principle, and an attempt to associate entropy with light sheets, which is controversial. We could have a whole discussion about that. Actually, it's part of the other discussion. Now, so let's do what was suggested and pursue this to its logical conclusion, which is that black holes are unstable. I'm going to forget about angular momentum and charge for the moment, because it's an irrelevant complication at this point. So, I think what you were saying is you start off with a black hole of mass M, zero, and you say, well, it will pair produce particles like this, and these go off and give you black body radiation. What happens to the ones going in? Conservation of energy tells you that the rate of change of the mass of the black hole must be equal to minus the rate of loss of energy. Due to radiation. The temperature of the radiation in the absence of angular momentum and charge is proportional to 1 over m. So if you want to estimate this, it will be Stefan-Boltzmann constant to the power, Stefan-Boltzmann constant. The temperature of the hole to the power 4 times the area of the hole, in other words, the area of the thing that's radiating, and this is going to be approximately minus 1 over m squared. the fact that there's an instability, you can see from this. If I wrote it the other way up, I would say the energy looks like 1 over T, and therefore the specific heat is dm dt, which is equal to minus 1 over T squared, which is less than 0. So you can tell that something unstable is going to happen simply because the specific heat is negative. There aren't many systems that have negative specific heats. Saturated vapors are one obvious example, and they are unstable. For example, in the atmosphere, they make rain. So dm dt looks like 1 over m squared. So that tells you that the black hole will evolve. And we can do the integral. M squared dm is equal to minus some constant times t. Do the integral. And so m cubed minus m0 cubed is minus 3ct. So that at t equals 0, you've got m0. And at time t, approximately m0 cubed, the mass is 0. And the black hole has disappeared. I would like to write the lifetime on this table before answering the questions. This is 10 to the 10 years, in other words, one Hubble time. And that's a sort of important one astrophysically. This, of course, is ludicrously small, and this will be enormous, and I'm not going to consider it. Why do I say 10 to 10 years? I don't mean that. I mean 10 to the 50 years. Let me put in another one here. Mass of the pion. No, I don't want to do that. Let's put in 10 to 15 grams here. That's what I want to do. And this corresponds to a lifetime of 10 to the 10 years. I get that right. The density is enormous. I can't remember the density. The size is tiny. Oh, these things scale like m cubed. Now, the questions. This is as measured by an observer at infinity, yes. Yes.
Why does energy have to be conserved? Your pair producing stuff, and left to themselves in vacuum, they recombine and everything will be fine. But now your one is going over the Schwarzschild radius, so if mass energy is entering the black hole, it's going to fall on the singularity.
Unfortunately, we'll discover that energy flux across the horizon is negative. That's why the black hole can shrink in apparent contradiction to the area law, which says that delta A has got to be positive. That's why I was careful to say that the energy of the stuff that I was throwing in had better be positive. Are there any more questions?
This evaporation process, we expect it. Do you have to break down at some point?
Would
black holes
be small? Maybe. You don't know. I will tell you a little bit about this in a minute.
If the particles that are going across the horizon have negative energy, so what's the difference between like electrons that are falling in that were part of a pair that was created?
Well, since they individually conserve energy, the one that's going in has negative energy, the one that's coming out has got positive energy.
Okay, so they have energy just because of the gravitational
field. Yeah, they're being pulled apart, if you like, by the gravitational field. Very strange. You can do the same kind of thing with electric fields and pair produce electrons and positrons, actually. But there it's a bit different. You just have a huge electric field producing electron positron pairs, then there usually isn't anything interesting to back that.
Cool question. What does the black hole radiate as?
Black hole radiate.
So there's no...
Everything is defined by its temperature, nothing else. Possible minor corrections, but nothing important.
What's negative energy?
You might be trying to ask, how do I know that there is such a thing as negative energy in quantum field theory? I'll let the Tom answer that question. So where does that get us? Well, we have to decide how seriously to take this picture. So let's suppose for the moment that the black hole really does completely evaporate and try to construct a coherent picture of what is going on. So I can draw a Penrose diagram of that, and you see it's dramatically different to what happens if you just have gravitational collapse to form a black hole. Penrose diagram of that situation looks like this, where this is the rotation axis, symmetry axis if you want to call it that. An observer sitting out at infinity, moving up here, will see the black hole form in the usual way, but close to the horizon, particles will be formed, so you get the flux of radiation from the particle production process here, which propagates out to infinity. And then at some point, the black hole disappears. So if you are up here, it looks like the black hole has completely disappeared. Now, you might say, what's paradoxical about that? I can imagine an initial surface, which I pick, and a final surface that I pick. And since this is a quantum mechanical process in which I imagine black holes form and then disappear, it must be the case that I can act on this surface with a time evolution operator and figure out everything I want to know on this surface. In other words, U acting on the initial state is equal to the final state as measured on these two surfaces. Time evolution operator is a unitary operator. As I think we have learned exhaustively. Now, unfortunately, the picture that we have here, that can't possibly be true for. Because, well, for one reason, you can't, if you look at the evolution of this system, what you see is that there is a critical point somewhere around here. It's not clear precisely where it is, doesn't really matter where it is. Say a surface that looks like this, where you're interested in how states evolve from this surface to this intermediate surface. Some of those states will be described by functions which are non-zero on this surface. Some of them will be non-zero on this surface. And as this surface propagates a little bit into the future beyond this point, they correspond to states which are have support inside the horizon, and therefore cease to be measurable by anything outside. They have disappeared from this region. Nevertheless, they are supposed to give rise to a final state up here. To see that this cannot possibly be unitary, imagine trying to do this backwards. So you start with the final state. You act with U dagger on it, and you end up with the initial state. It's supposed to happen because in a unitary time evolution situation. So you start here and ask, where did this come from? The answer is that you haven't a clue, because there's lots of stuff in here that you could not possibly measure. So this gives rise to a contradiction. Such a situation cannot be described by unitary time evolution. That is the information paradox. To see how bad this really is, contemplate various ways of trying to resolve it. I will restrict myself only to serious possibilities. One, black holes do not evaporate completely. The idea here is that this picture is wrong. Let's have a different picture. But you have the original picture. Here is the radiation, but the black hole does not disappear. This result where the black hole evaporates down to some limit is a semi-classical thing, and at some point it just simply stops. It stops to give you a small remnant. However big the black hole was to start with. Yes.
What coordinate are you actually using for your time evolution?
A time as measured at infinity by an inertial observer.
So then wouldn't your surface never reach the black hole because proper or coordinate time never?
Well, no, in this picture it seems that, you see, if you're moving along here, the thing evaporates. See, once you're beyond this point, black hole has completely evaporated and has disappeared. So in the evaporating black hole picture, it's quite different to what happens to just a Schwarzschild metric on a sudden. So the trouble with this scenario, where you have a small remnant, is that it's supposed to contain all the information associated with a large, arbitrarily large, initial state. An arbitrarily large amount of information associated with a very small amount of energy seems not plausible. So for that reason, there's a tendency to reject this possibility. Second possibility is that the information about the initial quantum state is not lost to the outside world. That would require subtle correlations in the radiation that emerges to infinity. That seems to be implausible based on calculations of how these particles actually behave. But, of course, you can argue that since you don't have a sensible theory of quantum gravity, perhaps you have missed something out. Odd. Or perhaps the information gets inside, but miraculously comes out, which would violate causality. Or three, quantum mechanics breaks down. At the last count, I believe there were 17 other possibilities, but most of them are hybrids of these things, so I'm not going to consider them as separate logical entities. Nobody knows what the correct solution to this problem is. But somebody asked me about where the information lies that allows you to say that the density of states for a black hole was given by e to the s. That is to say, what were the internal states that we were talking about? So there are two theories about this. So this is an attempt to make sense of the statement that the entropy is of a Boltzmann nature.
By quantum mechanics does not work, you mean that unitarity?
No unitary time evolution.
Okay. Which would be?
Disastrous.
Yeah.
That does not stop some quite bright people supporting this viewpoint. So this is the Boltzmann view of entropy. So according to a string theory community, you can calculate the density of states, at least in one particular limit. Correctly, by counting the microscopic configurations of D brains with the same quantum numbers. Yes, it only really works for those that have zero temperature. The word really should be interpreted as meaning convincingly. Tuft and Susskind, and perhaps others, regard the entropy as arising from just the nature of the horizon. In which the horizon is regarded as a hologram of essentially the information falling in, with effectively one pixel per Planck area on the horizon. I am not an expert on loop gravity, but it is my understanding that the loop gravity people will tell you that they have some concrete realization of this. can't tell you any more about that because I think, roughly speaking, nothing more is known. Whether either of these is correct, I don't know. But my guess is neither is probably precisely correct. Your question?
Equilibrium mass, and or you could throw in a system with the same mass that's nicely low entropy, and they both increase the black hole area to the same amount, correct? And the information is to be stored in the surface area.
Well, if you can store a large amount of information, there's nothing stopping you storing less.
So you better have it. So you better have enough surface area.
So I don't really know what to say about that. You just know that the, well, I don't even know actually if this proposal really could possibly work to contain arbitrarily large amounts of information. It's a bit of a mystery to me. I'm not sure. But this usually goes by the name of holography, and it is certainly strange because you usually think of a system as containing the amount of information that is proportional to the volume of the system. Whereas, in holography, you require it to be proportional to the area of a system, or the area of the boundary of a system. Those two things do not scale in the same way, so it is definitely very strange. To say, volume looks like area to the 3/2. That's different from scaling like the area. So there's something very odd about this proposal. I can't tell you whether either of these are really right.
On the holography thing, wouldn't you not have to store arbitrarily large amounts of information? I mean, because you only have to store the maximum amount of information that an object can hold.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
throw an arbitrary large object into your black hole.
Yeah, but then it increases.
But remember, that's going to change the area, like the square of the mass.
Yeah.
Does that bother you? I mean, that should bother anyone. What should bother you is the information scaling like the area and not the volume.
Well, that does. I'm just saying that doesn't mean that you have to store arbitrarily large. That's all.
Well, it's an arbitrary large amount of stuff. Mass goes to large. We have a question how it scales with mass. Perhaps I should say that this possibility cannot possibly be described by anything like the local quantum field theory. Which, as far as I can see, includes string theory. So I think that neither of these should be taken as, well, since they're contradictory at some level, you can't take both of them seriously. But probably you should be deeply skeptical about both of them, at least in the other one. So both of these things are hugely active areas of research. But having said that, the walking paradox has been around 35 years and doesn't seem to change very much in that time period. So I think it is here to stay for a bit longer. Well, that is probably a good place to stop. Otherwise, we can discuss the alternatives forever, probably.
Everyone excited to present the leading lecturers with us.
Thank you very much. I hope it will put. Thank you. I guess I will see you at Wine and Cheese in 5 minutes, which is a good place to ask questions of a speculative nature.